Hey, lady, how you doing?
Hello, gorgeous. I'm fucking fantastic. How the fuck are you?
I'm doing well. Fighting off a bit of a cold. So apologies for my ratchety ass voice. Strike's over, so I can talk about whatever the fuck I want now.
I was just gonna say. I'm so excited.
Oh my god. Two things that I absolutely want to talk about, even just touch upon, even though this is 1,000 years old by now. Season 2 of The Bear is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my fucking life.
Oh, shit. I started it, but I'm very far behind.
Oh, my God, Amy.
But everyone has been raving about it to me. And
it's so good.
He's amazing. The episode they do that's literally the one shot is just perfection. I think it's like towards the end of season one.
I mean, it's so hard to tell who's the MVP of the season because it's like all of them. You all win. You all get awards.
Yes.
Oliver Platt is so good. Everyone is so fucking good.
It's such an amazing cast.
There's a moment, I have to rewatch it because you realize towards the end of the season that things have been set up. Episode 5 is like a big shift in the season. And there's several things that are set up for later that happen in episode 5, but there are things that are set up for episode 5 that happened before. So it's a thing like watch the whole thing through and then like go back because there's conversations of like, oh, remember when this thing happened? And you're just like, okay, whatever. And then it like comes up in another episode and you're like, oh my God, it's so good. It's so fucking good. Oh my God. Also,
shit. Okay, I gotta catch up on this now.
Fall of the House of Usher.
Oh yeah.
Has no business being that good. Mike Flanagan, thank you for just existing and being fucking wonderful in every way. And I was recently introduced to his Instagram account, which is wonderful, as is his wife. Katie Siegel. I don't know where the emphasis is in her last name.
I don't think I realized that's who he was married to.
Yes.
She's great. I also thought her first outfit that you see her in would be an awesome Halloween costume, which is like the suit jacket
yes.
with nothing under it and the snake tattoos. Yes. Like, be still my heart. You know I love snakes.
Oh, I mean, I definitely know where that bodysuit with the snakes is from. I was literally on their website today. It's Thistle and Spire, by the way.
In case you need to go buy that immediately.
In case you're into the like sexy, snaky lingerie. They also have Scorpio shit and tigers. I'm like, that's amazing.
All my boxes checked.
Exactly. I love the series. I'm in the middle of a second rewatch. And a fun little fact for anyone who has watched or is planning on watching. So if you're not familiar with Mike Flanagan's work, one, shame on you. Change that shit immediately. He's amazing.
What are you doing with your life?
What are you doing with your life? But he kind of came into prominence because he is the one who wrote and directed the Haunting of Hill House series, which is stunning in every possible way. So he does do a lot of horror remakes, but it's kind of not accurate to call them that because they're more inspiration as opposed to like a one-to-one remake. And this is no different.
I was going to say, you can very much see that in The House of Usher.
Yeah, like, for instance, like, he doesn't have kids, like, in the book. And in this one, he has 6 kids. So
yes.
So he references kind of all of Poe's work.
Through all of the kids, too. Like, each one is a different
story.
It's so clever. It's so well done.
It's so good. It's so good. It's so good.
The Telltale Heart episode is the last one I have seen, and because it was so traumatizing,
it is,
like,
yeah.
I'm still not fully recovered, and I watched it like 3 weeks ago.
I mean, it was my favorite to wake up to those texts, for sure. It was like, oh my God, no, 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 Monique. And I was like, I know.
I was losing my mind. I'm still kind of speechless over it.
It's so good.
It's so good, but it's so disturbing and horrifying.
It's traumatizing. Yeah, for sure.
But like in the best way, it's chef's kiss. Like,
it is. It's very chef's kiss. But there is, in the next episode, I told you this already, and this isn't a spoiler to anyone. So a lot of all of the characters actually are named after one of the characters in a Poe story.
Yeah.
Not necessarily Fall of the House of Usher. Because it's set up that it's kind of like if Succession were a horror series and all of them got their comeuppance at the end.
Yes. In the absolute best way.
It's absolutely. Phenomenal. Yeah. So because they're just, because they also run a pharmaceutical company that essentially is like selling opioids that are just killing everyone. So, of course, they have this like super high powered attorney fixer person who's played by the perfect Mark Hamill.
He is out of this world good.
Yeah.
Like, it took me a full 30 seconds
to realize it was.
Is that Mark Hamill?
Yeah, sure is.
It fucking is.
Sure fucking is. Mm-hmm.
Like, he doesn't even sound like himself. He's so great at voices.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Fuck.
Johnny informed me he does a lot of voiceover work.
Yeah, he kind of very famously was the voice of the Joker in the Batman animated series. Even I fucking knew that. I know.
So I love you, Monique. That's why we get along so well.
Yeah, he does a lot of voiceover work. Because he did have, like, a car accident that kind of fucked up his face while he was doing a Star War, which is why there's a certain Star War that's kind of like, there's no close-ups on him.
Shit. I don't think I realized that.
Yeah. I guess it, like, fucked up his face for him or what he was used to his face looking like. I think his face looks fine, but I also get it when it's your face. And then I think that that's really why he transitioned into voiceover work, not to mention he's fucking excellent at it. So in episode 6, which is right after the Telltale Heart episode, I think that the setup is like basically they have found out what has happened, and then he's like, I have to go and, like, you know, fix this basically. So his character's name is Arthur Pym. They refer to him as the Pym Reaper, which is fucking brilliant. So that character is named after the protagonist in the only novel that Edgar Allan Poe wrote, which is something to the effect of like the narrative adventures of Arthur Gordon Pym. So as he goes to leave the boardroom, he tells someone to cancel like the rest of his evening because he's having Richard Parker for dinner. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is, one, this is an excellent throwaway line that's brilliant. Two, it's related to the podcast because even though this isn't like the main story of the book, there is a section of it where there's a shipwreck and Arthur Gordon Pym and a cabin boy and this other sailor are on a raft. And after a few days goes by, they're like, oh, fuck, someone's going to have to be cannibalized to save the other two. So they draw lots. And it ends up being the cabin boy named Richard Parker who they cannibalize. So one, that's just a cheeky fun thing. But I did an episode related to this many moons ago. Don't even remember which one it was. That had to do with weird literary coincidences throughout time. Because 40 years later, there was a shipwreck and three people were on a fucking raft and then they drew lots and they ate the cabin boy who just randomly happened to be named Richard Parker. So find our episode about that and know that you'll be one of very few people who gets that reference in episode 6. It's a throwaway line.
This is why I love having you in my life, because I would not have caught that at all. And Monique, like, informed me before I even started the show. She was like, this is information you need to know because you need to have the same moment of realization and hilarity that I did when I heard this
Yes,
line.
And excitement. Yes. Also, so at my bar, it's not too far away from the Broadway. And lots of arty people come in. Broadway actors come in a lot. Regular actors, stage managers, sound effects people, visual effects people come in. So some of my regulars are theater producers. And this one woman, she produces theater with her husband. Her husband's also a playwright. And she was talking about how, which one, he's doing this musical, a wrestling musical called The Last Match. And apparently they actually hired like real wrestlers.
What?
Yeah.
That sounds so fun.
Yeah, I think it's going to London or it was in London. I don't know. It's getting a tour or something. So then she was like, oh, you know, my husband's show, I think it's called One Night in Key West, is going to be playing at Fulton in Pennsylvania. And I was like, oh, cool. And she's like, you're never going to guess what it's about. She's like, I'll give you 3 guesses. You're not going to get it. I'm like, okay. I was like, well, I'm going to guess it's about something that happens in Key West. And then she's like, yes. I'm like, cool. And then she's like, all right, I'll give you a hint. And I didn't even ask for the hint. She's like, I'll give you a hint. It takes place in 1918 in case that changes your answer. And I go, is this about Carl Tanzler? And she's like, yes. And I was like, bitch, I'm fucking incredible.
Oh my God. This is awesome. This sounds so horrifying, though. That was such a traumatizing story.
It is a traumatizing story. We also covered that. I specifically covered it in episode 40. So apparently one of the people who's working on the musical, who I think wrote the lyrics for it, refuses to acknowledge that he raped this woman's corpse at any point.
What? nuts.
Even though he put in a fucking paper tube in her vagina. It wasn't for her menses, girl. Like, be fucking real.
We know what's up. Yeah.
We know what's up. And, like, if that makes you uncomfortable, it fucking should. And then, randomly, I was listening to the latest episode of Last Podcast, and they did a whole thing on necrophilia and ended with Carl Tanzler. So it's a very unexpectedly heavy Carl Tanzler week for me.
Weird.
Also, I just want the record to show this is not a love story. It's awful and disgusting. And this guy wouldn't leave this fucking woman alone to the point that he stole and raped her corpse for between 7 and 9 years. This is not a love story. There's nothing on the record that showed that she reflected, that she felt the same way that he felt about her. She's just like, hey, could you cure me of my tuberculosis? That'd be cool. So it's not adorable. It's not cute. And everyone keeps saying it is.
What?
Yes. They're like, love never dies. I'm like, it's like if the guy who's harassing you at the bar all night, then like you died and then he stole your corpse and fucking raped it for 9 years. They wouldn't be like, oh my God, that's a love story.
That's not cute.
No.
That's creepy.
It's not cute. It's not adorable. Stop taking this from the guy's perspective. He harassed this woman. Like, after he got, spoiler, he gets off. He doesn't get charged with anything.
Ayo.
I mean, facts. The first thing he said is like, can I have her corpse back after his trial?
No.
No. And then they had to bury it in an unmarked grave so he would leave her the fuck alone. Only for him to fucking make, because he had like a death mask of her fucking body and then made another fucking doll to probably fucking rape and shit because he couldn't let this fucking woman go. It's not adorable. Stops calling it a love story. It's not. It's heinous.
Also, just like necrophilia in general, not super cute.
Mm-mm.
I don't like that.
No. I found out there's 10 different categories. There's 10 degrees.
What?
Yep.
There's a hierarchy of necrophilia?
There is. Apparently.
Oh.
Well, because like necrophilia can also just be like grabbing a boob, not necessarily like coitus.
Okay, that makes sense. Just like giving it a little kissing it, peck on the cheek situation. Okay.
I get, or like a fondling, or people who like do like a fondling and then they go and like think about it and like jerk off to it later. Like that's also considered necrophilia. Like there's a whole hierarchy.
I wish you could see my face right now. I'm just like, my eyes are like half closed. I'm like grimacing. I keep like pressing on my temples. Like that's somehow going to help the situation.
You know, it's moments like these where I'm like, how do I have any friends? Because they get subjected to these conversations.
Oh, I'm into it. I'm just horrified.
That it, as a concept, it exists. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. The musical is not presented as a love story though, correct?
Sure is.
Ew.
From his perspective. And I'm like, girl, no.
Like, I respect the creativity, but like.
Same.
No. Just no.
No. No. It's a love story and he never fucks the corpse. And I'm like, those two things are factually incorrect.
Yeah. Okay. I will not be seeing that show.
I don't. I mean, if I get comped, I'll go. But
also, you got to support your friends.
Exactly. I do have to support my friend. I did make it very clear. I was like, it's not a love story.
Just so you're aware.
And she's like, I know. And I was like, and she factually had sex with her corpse for fucking almost a decade. Again, if that makes people on the production who are writing this feel icky, then they shouldn't write it.
Yes.
Or not call it Carl Tanzler's whatever the fuck, or whatever, 190 US, and just make up a love story about some guy who doesn't fuck a corpse, who she loved him too.
Yeah.
It's not Carl Tanzler, because that's actually not what that is. Also, I started listening to What Went Wrong. It's wonderful.
Right? It's delightful.
I really like it.
I'm so glad. I'm running out of episodes now, and I'm like, oh, I don't like this. But yeah, I find them delightful, and they just have such random interesting information on like some of my favorite movies.
I love it. I just listened to the Bram Stoker's Dracula episode.
That one I listened to recently as well. That was particularly good.
Yeah.
I don't think I even remember seeing that movie, honestly, which now it makes me want to watch it immediately.
I absolutely fucking did. And I saw it in 1992, which means I was in second grade.
I was like, you seem way too young to have seen that.
Yeah, it was on HBO.
I love you. I've watched so many inappropriate movies because they were on HBO.
Oh, absolutely. 98% of the shit I saw.
Yes.
And I remember, like, going to school and being like, yeah, and then there are all these, like, hot fucking vampire chicks who are, like, their tits are out and they're, like, trying to fuck hard. Like, yeah, I was that chick.
I love it.
And they're just like, what are you talking about? Again, I didn't have a ton of friends.
Well, they're lost, honestly.
That's right. It's a great movie. I didn't realize that there's no digital effects in it.
Yes.
I did not realize any of that.
Everything is done practically.
It's so cool. But yeah, when you listen to any of the episodes, you want to watch the movie like immediately after.
Yes. Which a lot of them I haven't seen, honestly.
Yeah, so far I've only done movies I've seen.
Yeah, that's what I did. And then I ran out of movies. Then I was like, fuck, all right, I'm going to just listen to them and I'll watch the movies later. Having no idea what they're talking about.
I love it. That's all my shit. What about you?
That's all my shit. I did not really have that exciting of a week, honestly. I was excited when I heard the strike was over and I was like, finally, we can talk about the shows.
Yeah, I think it's pretty likely that actors are still going to get fucked in it, realistically. Yeah. But I was like, oh, I can talk about this now. So that's fun.
It's the silver lining. It's a little bright side.
Exactly.
I'm not going to go into it too much, but I am going to highly recommend the Boys spinoff show on Amazon Prime Video, Gen V, which I absolutely loved. It was one of those where, like, I was jonesing every week for the next episode. And it has a tie-in to the next season of The Boys as its season finale. And it's just, it's phenomenal. It's very well done. It's also very gory and horrifying.
That was my next question. Got it. Cool.
Yes. But in the best way.
I got to see if I can do that.
So yeah, that's it for me. That's my big excitement for the week.
I love it.
I'm excited for my paranormal story this week.
I'm so fucking excited for your paranormal story. Are you kidding? Let's do this.
And it's nicer to remember, so it's not too this one I tried to pick a fun one.
I love it.
So I actually heard about this story for the first time while I was researching my last story.
Ooh.
It was literally just this one-off line in the Mad Professor book about Eagle River, which is where BJ had grown up. And it was so ridiculous sounding that I immediately had to look it up. And I was like, all right, I mean, this is what I'm doing next week. So great. So we have like a Wisconsin theme for me for these 2 weeks.
I love it.
So this one's kind of a short one, but again, it was just too fun not to do.
Love it.
And since it's been a hot minute since I've done an alien story.
Yes!
That's what I have for you today.
I love it.
So, sources. YouTube.com. There are a couple of interviews with Joe Simonton on there, which I watched. WXPR.org, journalnews.com.ph, science.org, WUWM.com, which is apparently Milwaukee's NPR, The Washington Post, and hardcorezen.info. Joe Simonton was a 60-year-old plumber who lived in Eagle River, Wisconsin. Eagle River is a small town surrounded by forest and lakes close to the Michigan border. Joe lived in a rustic-looking, single-story wooden house by the forest. And when I say rustic-looking, like, really rustic-looking.
Oof, okay. So a cabin in the woods.
Cabin in the woods, yes.
Got it.
On April 18th, 1961, around 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, Joe was in his kitchen having lunch alone. His wife was in Chicago at the time, working at a department store. As he was putting his dishes in the sink, he heard a horrible noise. Quote, like the screech of automobile wheels as a car goes around a sharp bend fast, end quote. He looked up and out the window and saw this huge thing coming straight down, real steady and slow, just like an elevator. He said at first he thought the roof had come off of his house, but he knew that couldn't be the case because the roof was green and whatever the heck this thing was brighter than chrome. It had no wheels or landing gear and seemed to hover over the ground instead of fully landing. Curious, Joe rushed out to see what it was. By the time he made it outside, he saw a hatchway opening up near the top of it, which he described opening like the trunk of your car. Joe said the craft looked like it was two levels, like two bowls stacked on top of one another. It was about 12 feet from top to bottom and about 30 feet in diameter. The door appeared to be on the second level. The opening was about 6 feet from the ground and was fairly small, about 30 inches wide by 30 inches tall.
Then Joe saw a little man appear in the hatch. He said he was about 5 feet tall, around 120 pounds, and looked like he was, quote-unquote, Italian.
What the fuck does that mean?
He's like dark skin, dark eyes.
Okay.
That's what I took from that. Yes, I know.
I was like, is he doing like the Italian fingers? The Italian hands? Hey. Hey.
Ciao.
Yo, Billy.
I wondered the same thing. Like when I heard this detail, I was like, I'm already sold. And then I read the rest of the story and I was like, you had me at Italian, but I'm in. I'm in it.
Italian alien.
He appeared completely human as far as he could tell. And although he seemed small to him and his face was completely hairless, he could tell he wasn't a child and said he looked around 26 to 30 years old. The man was wearing a black flight suit looking thing. It was two pieces with a turtleneck. There were no visible buttons, and he had a form-fitting cap on, like he wore a helmet over it or something, like you see with astronauts where they have that little headpiece. But there was nothing on the suit. No writing, no metal, no ornamentation at all. The man was holding up a container that looked like a silver two-handed water jug and mimed to Joe that he wanted a drink. So he walked up to him to grab the jug. When Joe looked in his eyes, he said they were, quote, so penetrating, end quote, that he had to look away. But he took the jug anyway and went inside to fill it with water. Although he had no idea what was going on, he figured he'd see what happened. As he walked back to the craft, he could feel the man looking at him, but said he didn't/wouldn't look at him until he was right in front of him. The man had the same penetrating stare as before, and Joe said he felt like the man could see right into him, almost like he could read his mind. As he handed the jug over, Joe balanced himself on the craft with his left hand, and once the man took the jug, took a few steps back. The man set the jug down inside, then placed the tips of his right hand to his forehead and immediately withdrew it, which Joe believed was some sort of salute and took as a gesture of thanks. Not knowing what else to do, Joe returned the salute. Then he looked inside the craft. Although it was kind of dark, he could see the interior was black and immaculate, and there was enough light to see that there were two other men, nearly identical to the first, to the right of the hatchway door. But neither of them looked at him or acknowledged him at all. They were surrounded by these metal bands that they were attached to by a cord that he believed were for stabilizing them during flight. One looked like it was sitting at a control panel of some sort, and the other appeared to be cooking something that looked like a pancake on a square grill of some kind. Although he couldn't see any flames, it was clearly hot and there was smoke coming from it. Unsure what the other man was doing, Joe pointed to him and made an eating gesture at the other man, thinking he might get a conversation out of him. Neither of the two said a word, but the first man looked down at the water jug, then reached over, grabbed four of the pancake-type things, and handed them down to Joe. Joe said they were so hot and greasy, he could barely hold them.
So he says alien pancakes?
He's having alien pancakes, Monique. Yes.
What is the story?
I know. It was a one-off sentence in this book. And I was like, I'm sorry. This man had pancakes with aliens. Stop everything. I need to like do research on this right now.
That's what the sentence was?
Yes. Yes. I was like, this is so wonderfully insane in the best way. I absolutely love it. I will read the line from, I guess it's technically three sentences.
That's fine. I have no problem.
But this is literally what it said in the book. In 1961, a local plumber, Joe Simonton, brought the town notoriety when he claimed that three aliens landed their spaceship on his chicken farm, offering him some small pancakes in exchange for water. He said they looked like they were of Italian descent and were bad cooks. Apparently, the pancakes tasted like cardboard. And I stopped everything I was doing. And
that's incredible. That's incredible. That's the best three lines I've ever heard in my life.
It was like that. Sold. Sold. Say no more. I was like, how have I never heard of this story? It sounds insane. So I had to share it.
It's incredible.
They were small, about 2 inches by 3 inches, were very thin, rubbery, and porous, with little holes visible in them. But when he took a bite out of one, like I just said, he said it tasted like cardboard and thought, God help them if this is their food.
which I love. He's like such a character. His interviews are fantastic. He just seems like a good old country boy kind of, and it's just
I love it.
Amazing.
So they don't cook like Italians.
Oh, definitely not. No. Mm. He's like, you need to learn how to cook your pancakes because you're fucking it up. And he also thought if that's what they lived on, then no wonder they were so small. After giving him the pancakes, the first man reached up and quickly closed the hatch door with a heavy thud. And Joe heard what sounded like the door latching. When it was shut again, Joe said it blended right back into the craft, and it was impossible to tell where the door had been in the first place. As it sat there, there was a humming noise. Then the craft began to rise back up just the way it had come down. It went up about 20 feet, and then there was a quote-unquote terrible release of air from what looked like exhaust pipes, about 6 to 7 inches in diameter, protruding from the rear of the craft. Joe said it suddenly shot off towards the south at a 45-degree angle, and after about 2 or 3 seconds, it was completely out of sight. Joe said, quote, "There I stood in my driveway with a handful of greasy pancakes and my mouth open, wondering what the heck I'd saw, what had happened," end quote. I love this man so much. I'm never getting over the story.
No, it's literally same.
Joe looked down at the ground, but there were no marks. No sign of anything having landed there at all. The only sign that anything had been there was a pine tree nearby, which had bent completely back with the force of the craft's takeoff. But he said there was no real damage to it, and the trunk and branches were still completely intact. He estimated that the whole incident had lasted only about 5 minutes. Joe said he didn't know what to make of the whole experience. He hadn't said anything to them, and they hadn't said anything to him. Although it was by far the strangest experience of his life, Joe said he never felt scared during it. They hadn't seemed threatening or aggressive, and they had clearly been unarmed. Joe kept the incident to himself for a few days, but eventually felt that it was important enough to report to the local authorities. In a conversation 3 days after the event with Franklin Carter, a local judge with an interest in UFOs, Carter asked Joe to show him the hand he'd used to steady himself against the craft. Since he'd heard of people who had been close to UFOs and had been affected by radiation, but Carter reported seeing no burns or redness on Joe's hands. Carter, who vouched for Joe's honesty and reliability, eventually published an article on the event in the December 31st, 1961 issue of the Saucerian Bulletin. Saucerian? I'm not sure how fancy we're getting with this pronunciation.
I don't know. I'm here with for either of them. They both sound great.
Once Joe had reported the incident, however, thousands of people descended on his farm to have a look at the property and the pancakes. And there are photos of him with the little pancakes you can see online.
I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed with everything about the story. This is wonderful.
It's so wonderful, and it sounds so silly, but I love it so much. I won't get over it.
I love it.
Eventually, it caught the attention of Project Blue Book, which brought an onslaught of formal investigations by both the United States Air Force and the National Investigating Committee for Aerial Phenomenon, aka NICAP. Joe gave one of the pancakes to Judge Carter, who in turn gave it to UFO investigator Major Donald Kehoe of the NICAP for analysis. NICAP told reporters that the pancake had been returned without analysis, but Carter claimed in June of 1961 that he never got it back. A second pancake was given to Dr. J. Allen Hynek of Project Blue Book, and the third one was handed over to the Food and Drug Administration by the Air Force. After some analysis, an Air Force official reported that the pancake was determined to be, quote, pure buckwheat, end quote. Unsurprisingly, Joe Simonton's story was immediately dismissed and not taken seriously. Although investigators were skeptical of his story, they didn't believe that it was a hoax and that Joe was intentionally lying. The Air Force's conclusion was that he was just hallucinating. According to his file in Project Blue Book, quote, the witness was found to be a balanced person of good mental health, and that he actually believes the sequence of events really happened. However, the inconsistencies coupled with a lack of supporting evidence tend to indicate that the witness suffered a hallucination followed with delusion, end quote. However, Savino Borgo, an Eagle River insurance agent, independently reported having seen a flying saucer go past about a mile from Joe's house around the same time. And Phyllis Lorbetsky, another Eagle River resident, said that she and her 3 children also saw a UFO that day, in the same area where Joe lived. Both of which lend a bit more credibility to this otherwise seemingly very silly story.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that it's also worth mentioning that in the 1960s and 70s, there were multiple sightings of UFOs near Lake Superior,
and at one point the U.S. government sent jets from a nearby airbase to chase after objects spotted over the lake. While the following incidents are likely purely coincidental, it should also be noted that not long after the event, Joe reported that 23 of the chickens he raised, whose eggs he sold to his plumbing customers as a side business, had died since his encounter. The following month, the area suffered a power failure where all of the telephone lines were affected. Earlier that year, on February 24th, a B-47 bomber jet crashed 60 miles from Eagle River, and not long after Joe's encounter, on May 2nd, another plane crashed near that area.
Hmm.
The incident became known as the infamous pancake encounter, which is amazing.
It's amazing. I'm obsessed.
It's fantastic. And as far-fetched and silly as the story may sound, Joe never wavered from it. Although he later said he openly regretted telling anyone what he saw, since the demands from reporters disrupted the routine of his life and everyone treated the whole thing like it was one big joke. He said it had even cost him a number of plumbing jobs. In the interviews with him, Joe appears to be sincere and sane. And despite his lack of formal education, he seems like a trustworthy witness. After watching his interviews, it's hard to imagine him cooking up some weird-looking pancakes and making up this absolutely bizarre story. Throughout his retellings, the details stayed consistent, even though it seems like one of the interviewers was definitely trying to trip him up on the details. Whether you believe Joe Simonton just had an extremely vivid hallucination or was telling the truth and this really happened to him, Joe himself said, quote, "I don't care if nobody believes it. I know it's right, and I know what I saw," end quote. And that is the story of the time Joe Simonton had breakfast with some extraterrestrials in the incident known as the infamous pancake encounter.
I loved everything about that, top to bottom.
It was so much fun. Again, another shout out to the Mad Professor book for introducing me to the story because I had never heard of it before, and it's just delightful.
I mean, how can you just have a throwaway line like that and be like, I'm sorry, are we not, we're not coming back to that? We're just going to throw that in there?
I need more information, please and thank you. Yes. He was too busy trying to get to the lewds and lemurs. I get it. He had more important things to focus on.
Pressing matters. I totally get it. Yes. But like alien pancakes are up there too.
Right? I would love to have some breakfast with some aliens. I'll cook though, because clearly it's not going well.
I would love to get like an alien eggs Benny. Get that going.
Yes. Extraterrestrial hollandaise sauce, please and thank you. I'm done. I love that this was not a typical like gray scenario. And
Italians.
They're Jamie. Italian. Reminded me a lot of a few details from Terry Lovelace's story, which the incident at Devil's Den, which is where he saw all the crew members who actually did look like humans and were in like flight suits, which I believe did not have details on them, if I remember correctly. I might be misremembering. So I was just very fascinated by the story, that they didn't really look like aliens, but they were definitely in some sort of ship, and they're just having breakfast, sharing some breakfast.
There's nothing not to love about the story, Amy. Thank you for sharing it. It was wonderful.
You're so welcome. It was delightful, and I figured that was a fun, not scary one for nice November.
I love that.
Yay. I missed having an alien story. It had been too long, not gonna lie.
Yes, it had been. And I mean, this is like the one to end all alien stories, I think.
It's pretty wonderful. On that note, do you have some light traumatizing story for me this week?
Yeah, I think this story is hilarious.
Yes.
It is a crime because it's true crime. But last month I went on a tour of Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, which is beautiful and wonderful. And if you ever have the opportunity, you should go. And I've gone to several of their tours because it's not just like, they don't really do like ghost tours, but they'll do like historical tours. And there's even like a Cubans of Greenwood. And I was like, what the fuck?
What?
We're everywhere. So this was a crimes and catastrophes tour. And I was like, sign me the fuck up.
I love that.
And this was one of the gravestones we stopped by, was this story. And I was like, what the fuck is this story? So we're going to jump right into it. Sources: historicalcrimedetective.com, wikipedia.com, newyorktimes.com, history.nycourts.gov, SmithsonianMag.com, and Amazon. Harvey Burdell was born in Herkimer County, New York, in 1811. He came from a humble background, initially working as a compositor, or a person who arranges the texts and pictures of a book, magazine, or newspaper before it's printed. Later on, Harvey took after his brother John and studied dentistry in his brother's office in New York City, eventually opening his own practice across from John's. While Dr. Harvey Burdell prospered in his profession, he was penniless. Harvey was a gambler, and it seems like an all-around piece of shit person. Part of the reason he was broke was because, not shockingly, is that he had gambling debts all over town.
Oof.
Not only that, he was regularly sued by family members.
Oh!
Because, girl.
That's some next level shit. You look at your life, look at your choices.
10,000%, because he would borrow money from them to gamble and not pay them back.
Bro,
that's not the move. I mean, cool. I understand that it's an addiction, but like,
yo. No.
You're fucking dentist. Get your shit together. What the fuck? In an especially audacious this bitch move, in 1835, Harvey was engaged to a young woman whose parents were very wealthy. On the day of the wedding, after the clergyman and the entire wedding party had arrived, Harvey Burdell told the father of his impending bride that if he didn't give Harvey a check for $20,000 right now, he wasn't going to go through with the ceremony.
What?
Girl.
No.
There's like zero chill.
Seriously.
With the fuckery.
Yeah. He probably would have given you that as a wedding gift. Like, just relax.
Exactly. You would have gotten a house or some shit. I don't know. Like, fuck, yeah.
He's like, my bookie's calling. I need it immediately. Thank you.
Yeah. And I'm going to editorialize here and assume that the father bride told Harvey to go fuck himself. But what is a fact is that he clearly didn't take kindly to essentially being blackmailed by his future son-in-law on the day of his daughter's wedding and promptly called off the ceremony.
Correct. Yes. Who would be chill about that? It's super fucked up.
No.
It's gross. It's not classy, bro.
It's not classy. It's very tack.
Yes.
To shake down your fucking future father-in-law on the day of your fucking wedding. Bro, relax. Harvey Burdell continued his dental practice. And after a few years, Burdell was running a thriving business and had amassed a fortune estimated at $100,000, including the four-story townhouse at 31 Bond Street, where he both resided and practiced dentistry. The superfluous rooms he rented out to tenants. 31 Bond Street was on one of the most affluent blocks in pre-Civil War New York City. It was between the glitzier honky-tonk of Lower Broadway and the vice dens of the Bowery, of which he took full advantage of, earning him an especially seedy reputation. In his spare time, Dr. Burdell enjoyed gambling and, like in his youth, didn't like to pay up, so he owed gambling debts all over town. And while I sadly can't find any more information on this, apparently he was also a real estate swindler who was accused of embezzlement.
I mean, that tracks. Like, yeah.
Right.
I feel like that's not going shocking. Hand in hand with the gambling here.
Absolutely. But it was literally like just like a one-off. And I was like, wait, what? He's like a real estate swindler?
I have further questions. Yeah. Did exactly. he sell the Brooklyn Bridge for scrap metal? Like, what is going on?
I don't know. Maybe. Burdell, who was at this point unsurprisingly divorced, was also known to routinely have sex with his female dental patients at his practice.
Ew!
I know!
Unprofessional, dude. I came here to get my teeth cleaned. Like, get your dick out of my mouth. Thank you.
I mean, I hope the cleaning happens after. Just saying.
Oh, yes.
Not before. You know.
Preferably.
That's just polite. He also regularly hired sex workers, preferring girls in their late teens. Gross.
Ew, no. It's just getting better and better.
Yeah, this guy's the fucking worst. But we're going to put a pin in Harvey Burdell for a quick sec, and we're going to talk about Emma Cunningham. Emma was born Emma Augusta Hempstead in 1816 in Brooklyn. She grew up to be a very attractive young woman, and in 1835, when she was 19 years old, she met and married George Cunningham, a businessman 20 years her senior. And the two lived a relatively posh life in a rented house near Union Square. But he wasn't great with money, and by the time their fourth child was born, they had moved back to Brooklyn to live with relatives as George had squandered most of their fortune. In 1852, George died and left behind empty bank accounts, a little bit of property, and a life insurance policy worth $10,000. While that was a nice amount of money, Emma knew that that wouldn't be enough to support her family indefinitely, especially not if she wanted to move back to Manhattan and live as a proper lady. Using a portion of the insurance money to outfit herself in the latest fashions, the widow Cunningham set out about finding a new husband, one who could provide her and her children with the lifestyle they had become accustomed to when they lived in Union Square, and who would ensure that she remain among the ranks of New York's upwardly mobile middle class. Because you have to remember, at this time, if you weren't born into privilege, love, legitimacy, and security were hard to come by, especially if you were a woman. And Emma was desperate to make this happen. And at some point, she meets Harvey Burdell. So it's unclear how their paths first crossed, but the two were super hot for each other immediately, and things got very intense very fast. After a whirlwind romantic getaway in the summer of 1855 to a resort in Saratoga Springs that was essentially a nonstop fuckfest, Emma got pregnant.
Fucking love you, dude.
I mean, let's, come on.
Call it what it is, yeah.
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 Who doesn't love a nonstop fuckfest?
I mean, all my dreams.
Yeah, girl.
What the fuck else is there to do in Saratoga Springs?
Nothing.
Yeah, fuck.
The springs are freezing. I don't want to go swimming in them. Like, let's bang.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, look, that's nice. You want to fuck?
Yeah.
Great. So she gets pregnant, and she thought that this would ensure her a marriage proposal. Instead, she got an abortion, because while she wanted to keep the baby, he did not. So not only did she have an abortion, it's been rumored that Burdell performed the procedure himself in his dental practice.
Oh, no, no, no. That is not my mouth, sir. Stay out of it. Absolutely yes. Not.
Thank you for making that awful fact funny. I do.
You're welcome. That's what I'm here for.
I'm obsessed with you.
I'm obsessed with you. That's horrifying. You saying that gave me chills. Like, oh, I can't.
Nothing if not persistent, Emma moved into 31 Bond Street, but not as the lady of the house, but as a tenant, paying rent to Burdell.
Oh, what?
Girl.
I don't like this guy. Seems like a real piece of shit.
He is a real piece of shit. But also, like, girl, like, find another guy.
Yeah.
Emma moved in with her four children, and among the other boarders were the cook named Hannah Conlon and a man named John J. Eckel, who was said to be extremely friendly with Emma.
Oh, okay. I think we all know what that means.
Yep. But Emma acted like she was the lady of the house. She ran the building, ordered the food, hired the maids, and dined at Burdell's table, all the while continuing to sleep with him. While it appears that Emma did this with the intention that Harvey would look at her as wife material, she was essentially just his landlady who he fucked from time to time. And Emma Cunningham tried everything to get Dr. Burdell to agree to marry her. But to say their relationship had become strained would be putting it mildly. The two fought constantly, with neighbors reporting that shouts and crashes came from 31 Bond almost nightly. Burdell continued to refuse Emma's demands for marriage, telling a friend that he would not marry, quote, the best woman living, end quote. Because he just doesn't want to get married, which, fine.
Yeah.
But, like, this guy's a piece of shit.
I got very worried for a second due to our earlier conversation that I was like, oh, he's going to have to find the best woman dead? No.
Oh, no, God, no.
That made more sense.
No, no, no.
Thank you.
In September of 1856, Harvey accused Emma of stealing a promissory note from his office safe. Emma, in turn, initiated two lawsuits in the Superior Court. The first was a breach of promise to marry suit, for which Burdell was arrested, as breach of promise to marry was a criminal offense at the time.
What?
Yeah.
I had no idea that was a thing.
So, from what I understand, if you were engaged or, like, told a woman that you were going to marry her, that was the same as being married.
That was a verbal agreement, yeah.
It was a verbal agreement. So that meant you could get your fuck on.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay.
So, and then if you're like, JK, I'm welching on the deal, then you, like, sullied this woman's reputation and shit because you want to get your dick wet. Like, there's even like a small line in Titanic that alludes to this in the movie Titanic. Kate Winslet, Rose, tells Cal, her fiance, like, because he's like pissed at her because she's like, you know, gallivanting with Jack, as he should be. He's the worst, but like, yeah, also you're like engaged. So he's being a dick, and she goes, how you treat me this way? I'm your fiance. And then he goes, my fiance. He's like, you're my wife in practice, if not by law.
Oh. All right. Noted.
So this was a way to have, you know, still maintain your honor. If some dude was like, oh my God, I love you and I'm totally going to marry you. And then like, fucked you a ton. And then was like, JK. So yeah, definitely a criminal offense at the time. And the second was for slander. I don't really know the results of either of those lawsuits, but it's very evident that these were Emma's final desperate attempts to get Burdell to legitimize their relationship and fucking marry her. Can you imagine like seeing a dude being like, you said you were going to marry me. And then he gets arrested. It's like, I guess I'll marry you now.
Like, I feel like you're starting off on an awkward foot here.
Yeah, it's real awkward. She had become increasingly anxious to lock down a marriage with Burdell as she noticed the attentions he paid to other women. Emma became increasingly suspicious of Harvey's relations with his female patients, as well as with his attractive young cousin, who was also residing... Girl. But this was the thing, too.
Yeah.
At the time. Ugh. But, you know, super gross. On January 30th, 1857, a woman visited Burdell's office, and shortly afterwards, he took her on a tour of inspection through the house while in the company of the cook. Emma was not at home at the time, but when she returned that evening, she heard of the incident and grilled Hannah, the cook, about what went down. When she asked who the woman was, Hannah responded that it was the lady who was going to take the house and that Dr. Burdell was going to be leaving it, which I'm assuming it means he's selling it to her.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I would take that as.
Which probably meant that maybe all of the tenants would be in jeopardy if this woman was like, I don't want to rent out rooms anymore. When Emma asked when the transfer was supposed to happen, Hannah responded, the 1st of May, to which Emma allegedly replied, quote, he better be careful. He may not live to sign the papers, end quote.
Oh, shit.
Girl, don't have it in writing. Don't tell anyone. Just saying. I'm not telling you how to commit a crime, but just, you know.
You can think that if you want. Yeah. But just, like, keep it to yourself.
Yeah. Early that evening, Harvey Burdell left his townhouse at 31 Bond Street for a local hotel. He had recently been taking his dinners there, even though he had a cook on his household staff. Speculating wildly here, but possibly to get away from the constant fights with Emma. At 10:30 p.m., the man who lived at 36 Bond Street was about to turn in for the night when he said that above the noise of the rain beating against his windows, he heard someone cry out murder. He listened for more, but after that one shriek, there was silence. The man couldn't tell where the cry came from, so he just went to bed, which is the most New Yorker thing I've ever fucking heard of in my life.
I'm not going to lie. I haven't heard anyone scream murder, but I've heard some people yelling outside my building where I'm just like, shut the fuck up. I can't deal with this right now. And then I rolled over and went back to sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. At 8 a.m. the next morning, the boy who came in every morning to sweep the floor and light the fire in Dr. Burdell's office arrived as usual. When he opened the door, however, he found the doctor's butchered body on the floor. He ran screaming from the room and notified the remainder of the occupants of the house, who were calmly eating their breakfast. Emma appeared to be grief-stricken, while interestingly, John Eckel did not appear particularly disconcerted at the fact that someone was murdered in the same house the night before. Police arrived at the scene, and an inspection of the body showed that the doctor had been stabbed 15 times and strangled for good measure.
Holy fuck.
Girl.
It's a little excessive.
It's a lot. It literally is overkill. The New York Daily Times reported, quote, the body was lying upon the floor, shockingly mutilated and surrounded with clots of blood, and the door and walls of the room besmeared with blood, end quote. Harvey Burdell's funeral took place the following day at Grace Church on Broadway and 10th Street. More than 8,000 people tried to cram themselves into the church for the service. And never to be outdone, Emma Cunningham dramatically threw herself on Burdell's open casket and cried, quote, oh, I wish to God you could speak and tell who done it, end quote.
Like, settle down. You're not getting an Oscar here. Relax.
Girl, this story's wild. Then, 2 days after Harvey Burdell's body was discovered, Emma presented the coroner's office with a marriage certificate revealing that she and Dr. Burdell had been married on October 28, 1856 by Reverend Dr. Marvin, 3 months before his body was discovered.
That's highly convenient.
Mm-hmm. Meaning that not only was she Burdell's grieving widow, devastated by his death and horrified that anyone could have such animosity towards her beloved husband, but with this little piece of paper, she was also the sole heir of his $100,000 fortune and various properties, including the townhouse at 31 Bond Street, which is one hell of a motive. All the members of the household, including Emma Cunningham, her 4 children, and their servants were placed under house arrest. A 14-day coroner's investigation was held and took place in the dead man's office.
Oh!
Girl.
No!
Girl. With witnesses testifying in the chair where his patients had recently sat, and with one person even recommending that one of Burdell's eyeballs be removed and his retina examined for traces of what or whom he saw in his dying moments. Thankfully, this proposal was shut down. But on a side note, if that kind of sounds familiar to you and you like trash movies,
Wild Wild West!
Do you know where this is from?
Yes, I love you.
I fucking love you.
I love you. I love that movie. I fucking love you. It was so trash, you're right, but I love trashy movies. Oh my God.
Oh, absolutely. I love it. Absolutely. You. This is literally a major plot point in the 1999 bomb Wild Wild West, starring Will Smith, who, by the fucking way, turned down playing Neo in The Matrix to star in Wild Wild West.
Insane.
I'm obsessed with you and I love that I love you and I'm never going to stop.
I love you. That is like the one part of that movie that I will never forget because it was simultaneously traumatizing and so deeply fascinating for me. Like I knew it wasn't real, but I was like, this is such an interesting idea. I was obsessed. Yes.
Literally same. And given that Wild Wild West takes place about 12 years after this case, it just seems like this was the thing that people around that time believed you could do. Also, I'm obsessed with you, and I'm never going to stop.
I'm obsessed with you. I love. I was literally thinking this entire time, and then you mentioned it, and I was like, this is why Monique and I are psychic sisters. Like, this is beautiful.
Exactly. Medical experts also determined that the stab wounds were made by a left-handed person. Interestingly, Emma Cunningham was left-handed.
Ooh, Emma. It's not looking good for you, girl.
Emma, girl. Mm. The case was delivered to a grand jury, where Emma Cunningham was indicted for the murder of Dr. Burdell. She was placed in the Tombs, a New York City jail, awaiting her trial. Top defense attorney Henry Loring Clinton represented Emma, and the New York City district attorney, Abraham Oakley Hall, was the prosecutor. Fun fact, Hall later became the mayor of New York City in 1869.
Oh, shit.
Look at that. I don't know. It's not like, oh, my God, really? Like, I don't know who this person is. But for someone who does, that might be interesting to you. And this trial was as salacious as it fucking gets. It was as notorious as the O.J. Simpson trial and was accompanied by a full-on media circus. And let me tell you, the press had a fucking field day. The press painted Emma as a gold digger who had been sleeping with John Eckel in addition to who knows how many other boarders at 31 Bond Street. It was reported that she allowed one of her lovers to engage in immoral acts with her 18-year-old daughter.
Oh!
I don't know if that's true and if they're just like being like, this person's such a piece of shit, they even do this. Household staff and neighbors came out of the woodwork with stories of lurid sexual escapades and elaborate plots to ruin the good name of the dentist who had worked so hard to rise the ranks of the professional class. This guy's a piece of shit. Let's be real.
Yeah. Did you hear his backstory? No. Relax.
He tried to shake down his fiance's fucking father on the day of the wedding for 20 grand.
Yeah.
Her trial began in May of 1857. The prosecution called the cook, Hannah Conlon, to the stand, who repeated her conversation with Emma, who allegedly said that Burdell might not live to sign the papers for the woman who was set to take over the house. Other servants of the house testified that Emma had told them that the doctor was not fit to live. On the witness stand, Harvey's cousin recounted one of the victim's last conversations that he had about Emma. The prosecution asked, did he speak very highly of her? Cousin, yes. Prosecution, did he tell you that she was a rich widow? To which the cousin replied, quote, yes. He said she was ladylike. He said that to have a public outbreak with her, he feared, would injure his business. He said she was a cunning, intriguing woman, and that she would resort to anything to carry out her plans, end quote. While all this wasn't a good look for Emma, the prosecution relied most heavily on physical evidence. The murderer was almost certainly left-handed. Emma Cunningham was left-handed. Check and mate. But if this was the Victorian equivalent of the O.J. Simpson trial, Emma's attorney, Henry Loren Clinton, was her Johnny Cochran. Clinton smartly did not have Emma testify in her own defense, and he pointed out that while his client was indeed left-handed, who knows how many others across the city are also left-handed, which is fair. Not only that, the crime scene indicated that Harvey Burdell put up one hell of a fight against his attacker before succumbing to his injuries. Emma was an aging woman in her mid-30s who suffered from rheumatis.
Ow.
Burdell had, ow. I mean, girl.
That hurts my feelings. Stop.
I mean, I'm in my late 30s, so like, how am I even alive?
This geriatric woman in her 30s, like, fuck off.
Burdell had 12 inches of height and 100 pounds on her. Even if she wanted to kill him, how could such a delicate creature commit such a physically demanding act? She has weak arms and she's a woman. She can't do it.
My uterus got in the way? I'm sorry.
Clinton painted a portrait of Burdell and his relationship with Emma that was much darker than had been in the initial press accounts. Clinton brought up the $20,000 shakedown of Burdell's former soon-to-be father-in-law on the day of his wedding, that he engaged in sexual relations with his female dental patients, that he owed gambling debts all over town and was frugal to the point of cruelty, almost starving his servants. He'd been, the defense claimed, especially abusive towards Emma. Court papers alluded to a variety of sexual assaults, including two rapes, verbal abuse, and humiliation. Clinton spoke of the abortion Emma had been forced to undergo in the fall of 1855, but revealed that it was not her last, that she had had several others, all of which had taken place at the dentist chair at 31 Bond Street. And because the press has basically always been trash, one newspaper claimed to have obtained from a secret cabinet in Burdell's office a jarred fetus, which was the result of Cunningham and Burdell's relations.
What the fuck?
I'm certain this is not real. I'm certain it's not.
That seems like tabloid trash. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Burdell's wildly unsavory reputation made any accusation against Emma difficult for the prosecution to make credible. Not only that, there was no actual physical evidence tying Emma to the murder. So on May 9th, 1857, after less than 2 hours of deliberations, Emma Cunningham was found not guilty of Harvey Burdell's murder. And the press lost their fucking minds, with newspapers across Manhattan exclaiming that the wicked woman had gotten away with murder. Spoiler, I think they're right.
Yeah.
But Emma's legal battles were far from over, as there was still the little matter of Emma's alleged marriage to Burdell, which was being investigated by the surrogate court at the same time as her murder trial. Emma argued that as Harvey Burdell's wife and only direct heir, she was entitled to his $100,000 estate. To explain why this marriage was being contested, it's important to note that at the time, marriages were conducted by a clergyman and witnessed, but not registered with any office of the state to make it legal and valid. The marriage certificate in question was signed by a clergyman, both parties, and two witnesses. When interrogated, the clergyman recalled performing the ceremony. But several of Burdell's inner circle had challenged the marriage certificate as fake, not believing her assertion that Burdell had sworn her to keep their marriage a secret, especially from his own attorneys. The only way to invalidate the marriage would be to prove that it was an imposter and not Dr. Burdell himself who appeared to be married. So Samuel J. Tilden, who would also become future governor of New York and a presidential candidate, represented the Burdell family in this case and presented the following scenario of what they believed actually went down to the court. Emma Cunningham was having an affair with another of Burdell's tenants, John J. Eckel. She had hired a minister who neither knew Eckel or Burdell and disguised Eckel in a fake beard to match Burdell's real one and then married Eckel, who forged Burdell's signature on the marriage certificate.
Amazing.
I mean,
I respect the effort that you went through here. Like, all right.
Oh, girl, you haven't seen effort.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
Girl. And the press fucking ran with this suggested motive that Eckel and Cunningham were drunk on lust and greed and had conspired to murder Burdell and live together for the rest of their lives on the dead dentist's dime. Important to note that while John Eckel had also been indicted for Harvey Burdell's murder, his case was eventually dismissed without trial. Emma's every move was publicly scrutinized. It was reported that men of all ages were seen to be entering the house at all hours of the night. The implication wasn't just that she was a quote-unquote loose woman, but that she was also engaging in sex work, as the area around Bond Street was widely recognized as a red-light district. And while there was no evidence that Emma ever engaged in sex work, the newspaper coverage had insinuated it enough that the obsessed public were much more inclined to believe that she was, quote-unquote, that type of woman. The circuit court's decision regarding the validity of Emma's marriage and her right to Burdell's estate was expected in late August. In July, she appeared in court looking noticeably fuller around her midsection. Because yes, she was pregnant with her late husband's child. And no, she would not be submitting to any physical examination by anyone other than her own physician.
Oh my God.
Girl.
The level.
The level's insane. From her initial pregnancy announcement, there were whispers that Emma was padding her gowns with pillows and faking exhaustion and other symptoms of her condition. Why would she fake a pregnancy, you ask? Well, in those days, if your husband died without any children, you would receive the widow's share, which was one-third of the deceased estates, and top-tier bullshit. But if you had a child, you would get the entire fucking thing. But spoiler, it's a fucking lie. Emma wasn't pregnant.
Which, like, always confuses me because it's like, they're gonna find out when you don't have this baby. Like, why?
Wait, girl, we're fucking getting into this shit.
Oh my God, wild.
I think if she spent any time, any of this type of effort doing something legit, she would be like a fucking millionaire.
Yeah.
Because, like, the effort knows no bounds. So she's not pregnant. She's faking this pregnancy. But she knows if she is going to fake a pregnancy, she needs to get a doctor in on it. So she approached Dr. Uhl, I believe is his name. It's UHL. So let's say Uhl. With a proposition. She would give him $1,000 if he would procure a newborn child at the proper time and make an affidavit that he attended her during her labor and that she was the mother of the infant. And the doctor was like, oh my God, absolutely, that sounds fucking great. But in reality, he went straight to the district attorney.
Okay, good. I was like, this bitch went all out. Like, girl, wow.
No, you don't, girl, we're getting into it. This story's fucking wild. We're getting into it. So he went to the district attorney and told him this wild-ass plot and advised him of all of his movements. Dr. Uhl then announced that Emma Cunningham was due around July 28th, 1857. Dr. Uhl, along with District Attorney Hall, made arrangements to borrow a baby from an indigent woman for a short time. Apartments were engaged at 190 Elm Street, where the child was born, and as soon as possible after its birth, Emma would be called and, disguised as a sister of charity, would sneak the baby out in a basket back to her home on Bond Street.
I can't for 1 minute with this.
Girl, on the day of the show, at about 10:30, Emma became quote-unquote very ill, and Dr. Uhl was sent for, and he brought his associate, Dr. Delamontagne, who also just happened to be the godfather to District Attorney Hall's daughter. They were brought into the room, and Emma was taken to bed. And after putting on a whole show, moaning and shrieking for several hours...
Oh my God.
Girl, this is like method shit.
Yeah.
I'm a little impressed because of the commitment. Dr. Uhl announced that Emma had given birth and that mother and child were doing as well as could be expected. Once the announcement was made, District Attorney Hall and a squad of police officers appeared on the scene, and what a fucking scene it was. Emma went so far as to stage a birth scene at her home. The New York Daily Times reported, quote, "A fictitious afterbirth had been prepared and a large pailful of lamb's blood."
Oh my God.
"The bloody sheets of Mrs. Cunningham's bed and the placenta stowed away in a cupboard, complete with mock confinement, which had also been systematically accompanied with imaginary pains of labor," end quote. She went all the fuck out.
Bitch is wild. Okay.
Yes.
You're right. I was not prepared for the level of this.
No. This is fucking nuts. Like, if she worked, she could have made the fucking $100,000 if she worked this hard at literally anything else.
Yeah. Stay away from the lamb's blood. Just, like, get a job.
Exactly. After Emma presented the newborn as her own, Hall produced the baby's biological mother. When Emma insisted that it was her baby, the thing is, Hall had a series of small marks made under the arms of the baby that had just been born in the Foundling Hospital. And wouldn't you know it? Emma's baby had the exact same marks. Because it's not her fucking baby.
Yeah.
Emma Cunningham was promptly arrested and found herself once again in the Tombs, where she had already spent 2 months while awaiting her murder trial and on the front page of every newspaper in the city. Her defense attorney, Henry Clinton, had Emma's new charges swiftly dismissed based on lack of evidence of a crime and entrapment, and Emma was once again released. The judge in the surrogate's case regarding the validity of her marriage was negatively influenced by the whole fake pregnancy and baby thing, and ruled that Emma Cunningham, although acquitted of any wrongdoing, would not inherit any money or property from Burdell's estate. The baby's biological mother, however, did find a way to capitalize on the situation, cutting a deal with showman P.T. Barnum to exhibit the child at his downtown Manhattan museum
for
visitors. Girl, I can't with anything of this fucking story.
What?
Visitors could pay 25 cents a head to gaze upon the infamous baby.
Wow. There's really nothing to do back then. I get it.
No.
I guess.
Other than everyone being top to bottom trash. Like, that's just it. From August 1857 onward, Emma Cunningham was a free woman. However, her reputation was forever tainted, as she would always be suspected of being involved in the infamous murder. Disgraced and penniless, Emma fled to California at the end of the year. In 1859, Emma moved to San Francisco, where she married a retired sea captain and was able to set up her daughters in respectable marriages. She returned to New York City in 1887 to live with a cousin, where she died penniless later that year. Her death was reported in a small notice in the New York Times on September 18, 1887. Emma Cunningham was 69 years old. While Harvey Burdell's murder was never officially solved, modern scholars agree Emma was likely involved. The pair were disowned by their families, and for well over a century were buried in unmarked graves just 100 yards away from each other in Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn. The two were eventually forgotten, their whereabouts known only to a few history buffs. That is, until 1998, when Jeffrey I. Richman, the historian of Greenwood Cemetery, read an account of the case and included it in a book about the cemetery. In 2000, a retired lawyer, real estate developer, and budding historian named Benjamin Feldman bought the book and became obsessed with the twisted tale of Harvey Burdell and Emma Cunningham. Feldman said, quote, "The interplay between them is one of the most hideous, dysfunctional, psychopathic couplings between man and woman I've ever read," end quote. No shit. But that being said, Feldman had a type of respect for them and made it his mission to see their graves appropriately marked. Benjamin Feldman partnered with Greenwood Cemetery, and on September 18, 2007, exactly 120 years after the New York Times announced that Emma Cunningham had died, two sparkling granite headstones were unveiled, one for Harvey and one for Emma. Harvey Burdell's gray granite tombstone is etched with a weeping willow and reads, "Harvey Burdell, 1811 to 1857. And it has this quote at the bottom of it. "We humbly beseech thee, O Father, to raise us from the life of righteousness, that when we shall depart this life, we may rest in him." Emma's gray granite tombstone has a beautiful tree etched on it and reads, "Emma Augusta Hempstead Cunningham, 1818 to 1887. May God rest her troubled soul. And that is the crime of the century, the murder of Harvey Burdell by not legally, but absolutely Emma Cunningham. And if you're interested in reading more about this, Benjamin Feldman published a book about it in 2018 called Butchery on Bond Street, Sexual Politics and the Burdell Cunningham Case in Antebellum, New York.
I fucking loved that.
I mean, how fucking nuts is the story?
It was so wild. I did not expect the level of this. I learned so many things about marriages and the law that I did not know prior to this. Yeah.
It gave me lots of, like, Chicago, like when we did the Chicago vibes of, like, well, she can't do it because she's a woman.
Yes.
Women don't murder.
I was thinking that as well. Little old me and my weak arms. My weak left hand. I couldn't possibly have stabbed him.
God. So I saw their grave markers when their tombstones when I
was
there.
That's so cool. I still have to go to Greenwood Cemetery.
We gotta go.
I've been saying
it's so beautiful.
For literally 3 years and I have not gone. And it's right up the block from me, basically.
Yeah, we should go. We'll do a date.
I would love that. I would love a date with you. Thank you so much for that story. That was so fucking good. And I was not prepared.
Twists and turns.
I love it.
What the fuck?
You never disappoint. You always deliver.
I mean, girl, you give me alien pancakes. Are you kidding me?
I could not get over the alien pancakes, which now I'm really craving pancakes. I'm not going to lie.
I mean, kind of same.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with you.
I'm obsessed with you.
And I'm obsessed that you knew exactly the reference to Wild Wild West. I'm really obsessed with you.
Yes. Besides the giant mechanical spider at the end, that is like the only part of that movie I remember.
Literally same.
Yes.
Literally same.
And they had to turn the head upside down because it was...
Yes. Because of the optical, yes.
Yes.
Girl, I fucking love you so much. My God.
Oh, I love you. Read my mind. Psychic sister.
Just when I think I can't love you more.
I prove
her
wrong.
Hit me with this shit.
Time and time again. I love it. Same.
I love you.
I love that I was literally sitting there thinking, like, this sounds like Wild Wild West. And you were like, by the way, this sounds familiar.
By the way, you've seen trashy movies. You know this.
You know I have, Monique. I love a trashy movie.
Same, girl.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you. And thank you guys for listening. This is another fucking horror podcast. I'm Monique Sanchez.
And I'm Amy Traden.
You can find me on the gram at pinupgirlmo.
You can find me at lobotomy, and that's lobot period Amy.
Also, follow us on the gram. We're at another fucking horror podcast. And every sixth episode, we do a True Listener Tales episode where we read your true crazy stories. So if you have one, or you just want to say hi, you can email us at anotherfuckinghorrorpodcast@gmail.com with a period instead of the U in fucking. Also, if you really like the show, tell your friends about it. Write us a review. Like, the more reviews we get, the more exposure we get and visibility we get. And if we get more of that, then we can do this full time and quit our bullshit jobs. Yay!
Yay!
That would be so appreciated if you could help us out with that. And as always, keep it cute.
Keep it creepy. Bye!